I am thankful for each and every one of you that showed up this evening. If our brother gets his computer up and running, I pray that you're prepared to hear the word that he's going to speak to us this night. I give you our speaker of the hour, Brother Tom Mackey.
Thank you.
I would like to consider this. Is it on the screen?
No.
Nothing on the screen? Come on. It's not on the screen? Is it plugged in the wrong hole? Got it now?
Yeah, now you just got to find it again.
Okay, get my doc. Okay. After watching all the trouble this morning, I was afraid something like that would happen. On there now? I would like not to consider this a PowerPoint program about the Book of Mormon. I really guess it's more of a sermon that's just illustrated, and I hope the illustrations will help somewhat. In 1 Peter, in chapter 3, there's a little verse there that I like, and it says, "Always be ready to give the reason for your hope." Give the reason for your belief, your faith. Well, I know that the reason that you believe in the Book of Mormon is because you have been touched by the Spirit of God. You've made it a matter of prayer, and He has revealed to you the truthfulness of it. But that isn't good enough for everybody. And so I would like to present some evidences of the validity of the Book of Mormon, its truthfulness. If we're going to talk about evidence for its truthfulness, there are three factors that we need to consider. It claims to be a divine history of God's dealings with a portion of the house of Israel. It claims to be a historical and religious record of a people who traveled from Israel to America in the 6th century B.C., and spans the time until their ending, their demise in the 4th century A.D. It claims also to have been revealed and have been translated by the power of God. As to this third claim of it being a divine history of God's dealings with a portion of the house of Israel, let's yield the floor to some literary authorities of our day. One man who has written an interesting book called A Literary Approach to the New Testament, John Pritchard, he quotes in his book a famous literary scholar of the past century. His name was August Boak. And this is what he wrote. He said, "If a sacred book of human origin, it must be understood according to human rules in the treatment of usually applied to books. If it is of divine origin, it stands on a level above all human interpretation and can be apprehended only through divine inspiration." And really and truly, that's just exactly what Moroni said as he wrote in the end of the Book of Mormon. He said, "And if you shall ask with a sincere heart, with real intent, having faith in Christ, He will manifest the truth of it unto you by the power of the Holy Ghost. And by the power of the Holy Ghost, you may know the truth of all things. We're looking at a well. I took a picture many, many years ago in a little town of Muna, near where our church work began in Yucatan. Concerning the second claim that we talked about, that it is a religious record of a people who traveled to America in the 6th century B.C., people of ancient origin, that there are three criteria that we need to show that a book is really and truly of an ancient origin rather than a modern origin. Those three criteria. It must describe a condition of social organization which is harmonious with archaeological and known documentary evidence relative to this area and time. It should present a description of the cultural setting which is harmonious with the known facts about the time and place of the setting. There should be nothing unreasonable about the story itself. I would like to demonstrate that the story found in the Book of Mormon is consistent with the true history of ancient Mesoamerica. In fact, I think we can show that the Book of Mormon narrative accurately describes a cultural and a historical setting of a region before anyone else in the world was even aware of it. That last fact alone should be sufficient proof that no man, no group of scholars could have written this book in 1829. This in itself is evident for its claim that it was brought to light by the power of God. In this study, we're going to discuss three types of evidence that are important to the proof of the Book of Mormon. The first is anthropological evidence. Anthropology is the study of the people themselves, of their traditions, their culture, their religion. This is a picture I took in 1953. After a service, we retired to a little kitchen in the back of the home of Sabino Cabrera, and his family prepared a meal for us. But we're going to talk about the cultural setting found in the ancient people and compared with the Book of Mormon. Next part is archaeological evidence. Archaeological evidence refers to the evidence that is being found, recent studies made in the ruins and excavations that are taking place in Central America. And finally, and for me, most importantly, perhaps, internal evidence. That which is contained in the book itself should give us evidence that it is an ancient origin and that it is truthful. We're going to begin by giving our attention briefly to anthropological evidence, which demonstrates that the Book of Mormon accurately describes the culture, the traditions, the life, the religion of ancient indigenous peoples in America, in Central America. In 1 Nephi, we're going to read here a quotation. In chapter 5 of 1 Nephi, it says, "And we did put forth into the sea and were driven forth before the wind toward the promised land," in verse 181. And in verse 212, it says, "And it came to pass that after we had sailed for the space of many days, we did arrive to the promised land." On the Pacific coast, somewhere along the shores of Guatemala, El Salvador, or Honduras, arrived the people that we read about in 1 Nephi, who came from Jerusalem and were led by the hand of the Lord. The Book of Mormon indicates somewhat of their journey, that they probably encountered the counter-equatorial current that brought them there to the shores along Central America somewhere. The story of their arrival, what we just read there by Nephi, his story of coming here, runs completely contradictory to the beliefs and the ideas that were posed by archaeologists when I was a young man. It's completely contradictory to that. The theory, when I went to school, and no doubt when many of you went to school, was presented by in verse and Tom with also with this picture is presented by a historian and an archaeologist named Victor von Hagen. This is what he wrote. As a man, the Maya developed out of the various peoples whose common ancestors were the Mesolithic wanderers poured across the Bering land bridge, once connecting outer Asia to Alaska. These people then slowly dispersed through the Americas, developing their cultures gradually as they traveled southward. And this all supposed to have happened between 10 and 15,000 years ago. Completely different to the traditions of the Mayan people. The scientists who teach the classes and write the books at that time were completely ignored the traditions of these very people that they were writing about. Let's pay attention to one of those traditions. I, the first Azib Kiche, a term of Mayan leaders, the first Azib Kiche, right here on this paper, of the coming of our fathers and our grandfathers from the other side of the sea whence the sun rises. This was the cultural history, the traditional history, when the Spanish conquistadors arrived in Mexico and more importantly in Yucatan and Central America. This is the story that they heard over and over again from the Maya people. And another author, Racemus and Goetz, writing from the book of the Popol Vuh, the history that survived of the Mayan people, say this: the principal chiefs were four. Together, these tribes came from the other part of the sea, from Pa-Tulan, Pa-Sivan. These, then, were the three nations of Quichés, and they came from where the sun rises, descendants of Israel, of the same language and the same customs. This was the tradition of the ancient Mayans when the first Spanish friars began to talk to them and try to write down their history, and those records have survived to this day. And those records, many of them were kept in the catacombs of the Vatican. But today they're available. And this was the tradition of which they spoke. Another author writes of another set of traditions from another people. This is what this man said. Now, on the 28th of September of 1554, we sign this attestation in which we have written that which by tradition our ancestors told us, who came from the other part of the sea, from Sivan Tulan, bordering on Babylonia. Remember, anthropology is the science of their culture, their religion, their traditions. But the anthropologists give little heed to that, and they pay attention to other concepts that are developed by the wisdom of men. One of the early bishops in the Catholic Church in Yucatan was Friar Diego de Landa. He's the man who brought the Inquisition to Yucatan. He killed many people. He put to death in the city of Mani. He burned the Mayan library of all the ancient texts that they had preserved. Anybody who could read the Mayan language was put to death if they did not convert to Catholicism. Anybody who could write it was put to death unless they converted to Catholicism. But he repented of his sin, and he came back to Yucatan, and he talked to all the elderly people he could find, and he wrote a history, an account of things in Yucatan. That history that he wrote back in the 1500s, what became really the Bible of Mayan archaeologists. And this is what he said. Some of the old men of Yucatan claim to have heard from their ancestors that this land was settled by people from the east, whom God had liberated by cutting 12 paths for them through the sea. This old Mayan man I met in 1970 on my first visit to Yobain, he's the great-grandfather of our brother Placido. And I was glad to have met him at that time, a member of our church. considering this tradition that he has written about, Diego de Landa went on and he wrote his own concepts, and he wrote in his book, if this is true, it must be that all the inhabitants of the Indies were descendants from the Jews. Well, how close to the truth is his hypothesis? However, the world is full of critics of the Book of Mormon. If you talk about the Book of Mormon, you're going to run into them. You're going to hear their criticisms. And one of their criticisms we're going to talk about right now, because there are many. And it's in a book entitled Joseph and the Golden Plates. And it was written by a man named Gordon Fraser. And this is what he writes. There were no Semites in ancient America. There is no hint of any ancient transoceanic crossings to the New World by the Semites. Well, we know the Book of Mormon says these people were descendants of Israel. So they are Semitic by race. But critics say there are no Semites here. And so we're going to have to investigate that particular argument against the Book of Mormon. This is a city called Monte Alban. Hubert and I visited that city and took photos there of that city. In 1931, a Dr. Alfonso Caso, a Mexican archaeologist, discovered this city in southern Mexico. It was founded on the flattened top of a high mountain near the city of Oaxaca. It had been occupied in three distinctive time periods. The people of each period left graphic carvings which portrayed the occupants during that time. We will look at a carving of a figure of one of the inhabitants, well, of several of the inhabitants of that ancient city, but one particular 300 years before Christ. But first, I want to look at another figure. This figure in stone is found in a museum in Guatemala. And it takes me to the findings of a well-known scholar. Associated Press article appeared in the Arizona Republic back in 1970, and it said, Jews discovered America first. The article states, Cyrus H. Gordon, professor of Mediterranean studies at Brandeis, said the evidence is an inscription found in a burial mound in Tennessee in 1885. The archaeological circumstances of the discovery rule out any chance of fraud or of forgery. And the inscription attests to the migration of the Jews in eastern Tennessee. For example, there is a group of people known as the Malonians, who are neither Indian nor Negro, they are Caucasian, but not Anglo-Saxon. They are, Gordon indicated, descendants of Mediterranean peoples, and they believe they came to the New World in ships about 2,000 years before Columbus. That's just exactly the time frame when the Nephites made their journey to America. Interesting to me, you know, I don't really need to hear Dr. Gordon saying that there were Semitic people here. By looking at this figure in stone in Guatemala, I can see a Jewish rabbi today and any time in the past wearing the same kind of hat that he's got on and his beard trimmed the way it is. It's distinctive. There's no way of getting out it. But here we go back to Monte Alban. The figure in the foreground there, on the left and in the foreground, shows a Semitic figure, typical of the inhabitants of this ancient city 300 years before Christ. In the background, just almost in the center of the screen and behind him, there's another figure that shows a typical figure of the Olmec people who we equate with the Jaredite migration. They were the ones that established this city almost 2,000 years before Christ. But later it was inhabited by Semitic people, and perhaps the first ones were no doubt Semitic as well. Dr. Gordon, in his book called Before Columbus, elaborates on carvings like this one. He says there's no basis for saying they are simply descendants of Paleolithic hunters who wandered south from the Bering Straits. We know who they are racially from countless portrayals by ancient American sculptors. Now let's examine even more positive identification of a Jewish inheritance. We're looking at the phylactery stone. It's found in the Museum of Natural History in Mexico City, but it was found in the state of Veracruz many years ago. Dr. Gordon comments on this stela in his book, Riddles in History. He says, the main bearded figure holds his right arm half raised. A strip of leather is wound spirally around the forearm and palm, and then fastened around the thumb and other fingers. It is worn ceremonially by observant Jewish males while reciting their daily morning prayers. The personage has wrapped the phylactery strip around his arm 7 times, just as Jews still do today. It would appear to me that archaeological and anthropological evidence it seems to me that evangelical critics of the Book of Mormon who reject the story of ancient migrants of the Middle East coming here and the traditions of the Native Americans that support the Book of Mormon, that they place themselves in a difficult situation. What are they left with? They're left with the Bering Straits theory that has these people coming over from Asia 10,000 years before they believe man even existed. They don't have to worry about adhering to the beliefs and the teachings of the Smithsonian Institute, but they want believers in the Book of Mormon to conform themselves to that which is believed by archaeologists and writers and the men of the Smithsonian philosophy while they stay free from it. To me, it just seems like they ignore a multitude of the traditions and the legends and the carvings and the writings of ancient people of Mesoamerica. We read in the Book of Mormon that Jesus Christ, after his resurrection, visited America, just as it says in St. John chapter 10. Other sheep I have, which are not of this fold here, and they too shall hear my voice. And he visited isolated members of the house of Israel that were carried away by the hand of God to be safe from the destruction that came upon Israel. And if he really did come here to America, then we ought to find among the records, among the traditions, among the writings, among the sculptors of ancient Mesoamericans, we ought to find evidence that there was a white-bearded God who appeared here among them. One anthropologist wrote these words concerning a god that was found here in ancient Mexico. He said, just as our era began with Christ, that of the ancient Mexican people began with Quetzalcoatl. He is the central and most powerful figure in the mythology of Mesoamerica. As lawgiver, civilizer, religious teacher, he exemplified a way of life superior to anything known before. He was tall, with a fair beard and large eyes. This anthropologist named Gene Savoy, and that is found on page 15 of his book on Trail of the Feathered Serpent. The anthropologist Honoré writes this, the legend of a particular white god has survived to our day from the ancient civilizations of Central and South America. The Toltec and Aztec of Mexico called him Quetzalcoatl. The Incans called him Viracocha. To the Mayans, he was Kukulcan or Itzamna, who brought them all their laws, all their script, and was worshipped like a god by the entire people. In the Palace of Fine Arts in Mexico City is this beautiful work that is done by a famous artist named Diego Rivera. And this work is beautiful, and it's well known, and it's famous, and it is of the white god who appeared to the people here. And this is, he portrayed this beautiful figure by the legends and the traditions that he had heard and are written up to this day. He was known by a multitude of names. He was called the prophet, the pale god. But by whatever name he was known, he's always pictured in this particular way right here. Consider the parallel. The historian K.S. Laterette wrote, "Jesus is the most influential life ever lived on this planet." In the same way, anthropologist Séjourné calls this pale god of Native America the greatest figure in the history of the New World. What are some of the distinctive parallels between the two? I am hoping you can see this and recognize in the... It might be easier if those lights were off back there, because we don't need to read anything unless it's on the screen. Get them all. There in the center, you can see a figure with long hair and a flowing beard. It's on the back wall of a temple in Chichen Itza, and that temple has not had a roof for centuries, and the rain has had its bad effect upon it. But this is a beautiful figure. You can't, nobody can go up there and see it anymore. They're trying to protect all the ruins. I'm glad I got this photo many years ago. But this is the image of the bearded white god. The temple that is found in is called the Temple of Quetzalcoatl. The archaeologist A. Hyatt Verrill writes this: "This white god probably is the best known and famous of the Aztec gods, was the plumed serpent, or Quetzalcoatl. There are many myths and legends connected with Quetzalcoatl, but all agree that he was a white stranger with a flowing beard." Let's take a look at the temple. This is where he's found. You're looking at some of your Mayan sisters there, looking at this bearded figure, and around him on the stones, you can see the rectangular cut stones that make up the black wall. That are the figures of 12 other bearded beings. These 12 other figures, there is an anthropologist who gives us a good description of them. Her name is L. Taylor Hansen. She confirmed the identity of the 12 figures as his disciples from her studies of the ancient traditions of indigenous people of ancient Mexico. In her book, she writes about the time when their god was about to depart. I'm quoting her book, "He Walked the Americas." "The ultimate sign of his departure began to crowd upon them. He had chosen one of the priesthood from among the favored 12 who were always around him to be his successor." Another figure that's rather hard to see, and another one that you can't get close to photograph anymore, it's of the descending god in the city of Tulum over on the Caribbean Sea. Every temple has a figure of a god descending, and there are wings behind his arms, and he is, this is the city of the descending god. I would like to read what it says in Alma chapter 5, verse 18 and 19. "For behold, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and the Son of God cometh upon the face of the earth. And behold, he shall be born of Mary at Jerusalem, which is the land of our forefathers, she being a virgin, a precious and chosen vessel." Now listen to the tradition of the Caribbean Maya as they were talking to anthropologist Karina Shields. She said, "We are the Maya. We came from the east. We came out of the morning. Hunab-Ku, the all-god, was the one, the only one who knew. He saw and sent Itzamna, his son, to earth to teach man. Itzamna was made into child and then man, with a hand that blessed, and in turn, the earth blessed him." In the book of Helaman, chapter 5, verse 59, we read this: "And behold, there shall be a new star arise, such a one as you have never beheld, and this also shall be a sign unto you, a sign of the birth of a Savior." Anthropologist L. Taylor Hansen, in her book, He Walked the Americas, writes this about a tradition of indigenous people in the state of Oklahoma. "The God of the Americas told them that he was born across the ocean in a land where all men were bearded. In this land he was born of a virgin, on a night where a bright star came out of the heavens and stood over the city. Here too the heavens opened, and down came winged beings singing chants of exquisite beauty. In 3 Nephi chapter 5, we read that Jesus taught the necessity of baptism, that it should be, how baptism should be performed. Diego de Landa, that historian of the Maya in the 16th century, he wrote in his book, Account of Things in Yucatan, what the Bible of Mayan archaeologists, what it says about baptism. And this is what he wrote. There is no baptism in any part of the Indies except Yucatan, where it is even known by a phrase which means to be born again. We have been unable to discover the origin, but it is a thing which has always existed among them, and they hold it in such veneration that no one failed to receive it. I'm proud of Diego de Landa's confirmation about baptism in ancient America, but as a good Catholic bishop, the translation of the Mayan term got a little prejudicial. The Mayan term is oka, and translated directly, it means immersed in water, just exactly as Jesus taught, found in the Book of Mormon, and then shall ye immerse them in the water. And that was the Mayan baptism. In 3 Nephi chapter 8, verses 8 and 9, we read, I see that your faith is sufficient, that I should heal you. And it came to pass that when he had thus spoken, all the multitude with one accord did go forth with their sick and with their afflicted and with their lame and with their blind and with their dumb and with all they that are afflicted in any manner. And he did heal them every one as they were brought forth unto him. Now, in an ancient book written by an anthropologist named Charney called Ancient Cities of the New World, I want you to read what he said about Itzamna. There were brought to him the sick, the halt, and the dead, and he healed and restored them all to life by the touch of his hand. Exactly like it says in the Book of Mormon. A number of prophets whose writings appear in the Book of Mormon prophesied of the crucifixion of the Savior. Can such a family of us story like that be found in the lore of ancient Native American peoples? Almost all the tribes of Mesoamerica have such a story in their traditions. The Bishop of Chiapas, back in the 16th century in the land of the ancient Maya, writes this of their traditions about the sun. They say he was killed and lashed and a crown of thorns put on him, and that he was placed on a timber with his arms stretched out. They did not understand that he was nailed, but rather they thought that he had been tied. And there he died, and he was dead for 3 days, and on the third day he came to life and went up to heaven. And that he is there with his Father now. Well, you know, I fear some people might think, well, there's a little discrepancy there with he was tied to the cross in place instead of being nailed to the cross. But we must remember that these people had this tradition handed down to them for hundreds and hundreds of years by word of mouth. And it changed somewhat, which is really an evidence of its validity, of its truthfulness. If it had been word for word as we read it in the Bible, it would probably indicate that they'd been touched by some Catholic priest before they gave this testimony. So we're ready. I think we've shown in the traditions of the people, in the carvings, in the story of the ancient people, they believed so many of the things that we read in the Book of Mormon. So let's take a look now at some archaeological evidence that supports the record contained in the Book of Mormon. In 1 Nephi chapter 3, we read this. For it came to pass in the commencement of the first year of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah, my father Lehi, having dwelt in Jerusalem in all his days, and in the same year there came many prophets prophesying unto the people, that they must repent or the great city of Jerusalem must be destroyed. Well, historians know when this took place. They know when Zedekiah was ordained and made the king of Israel. And they list the date at 597 B.C. And so that's really when the story told by Nephi should begin unfolding in the 6th century before Christ. And this is a time sequence when I would have expected the Mayan civilization to begin to blossom in a new world. As a young man, I used to ride my bicycle from where I lived over by the state capitol to 11th Avenue and Washington, and there was a little round library there, and I read every book in that library about the indigenous people of Central America and North America. And you know, I was rather unhappy with what I read about the timing that they had possessed, they had added to this thing. And I'm expecting it to be somewhere in the 6th century that the BC, that the Maya people would appear in Middle America. And they don't come anywhere close to that. Let's read the words of an anthropologist in a book that his name is Listener, and he wrote a book called The Silent Past, and on page 315, this is what he said. Of all the peoples in the world, the Mayas probably evolved the most remarkable civilization, much of which seems baffling, contradictory, and inexplicable, and almost all of which strikes one as alien. Now, I kind of like that thought, alien to the rest of the history of the Americas. A. Hyatt Verrill, another anthropologist who studied quite a long time ago, he writes this, an abrupt and entirely revolutionary order of things, exactly as though the laws, customs, arts, sciences, industries, and social organization of the new regime had been bought ready-made and fully developed from another sphere or unknown land. And, of course, this is just exactly what the Book of Mormon tells us. In the ancient Mayan city of Chichen stands an old doorway. The lintel of that old doorway has a date on it, 842 A.D., Like most of the well-known excavated cities of the Maya, such dates are far, far later than the 6th century B.C., the arrival of the Nephite people here in America. This seems to pose a contradiction to the narrative history set forth in the Book of Mormon. And so this is my practice. It has been since the time I was a young man. When I find something contradictory to what it says in the Book of Mormon and our beliefs, I have to exercise my patience. I have to exercise my faith in the work of God and my patience with the work of man. So I did that. As we look at a typical Mayan Aztec motif, the plumed serpent, let's consider recent discoveries made in the ancient Mayan city of northern Guatemala. Richard Hansen of UCLA began excavating in the ancient city of Nakbe in February of 1989. His findings created a real stir among the scholars. I'm going to quote his findings. The discovery, described by scholars, surprising and exciting, puts the emergence of the elaborate Mayan civilization with large cities back to at least 600 B.C. It was previously thought that the Mayans did not rise above village level until 200 B.C. As we look here at the city of Edzna in Campeche, let's read the findings of another archaeologist in recent years, 1993. He wrote this, Mayan civilization banged into existence in its own way and time. It is unsettling for it violates the tacit rules of diffusion. You know, the Bering Straits diffusion down through Americas. And even worse, the tacit rules of gradual evolution espoused by modern archaeology. It's not unsettling to me. I've exercised my faith and my patience a long time, and that these new discoveries are verifying the story that is found in the Book of Mormon. Another Book of Mormon quotation. "And I did teach my people that they should build buildings, and that they should work all manner of wood, and of iron, and of copper, and of brass, and of steel, and of gold, and of silver, and of precious ores, which were in great abundance." Again, in 3 Nephi chapter 8, we read this. We're looking here at a sock bay. A sock bay, that's a Mayan word for a white road. This is a white road, a paved road built centuries and centuries ago. It says, "And it came to pass that there were many cities built anew, and there were many old cities repaired, and there were many highways cast up, and many roads made, which led from city to city and from land to land and from place to place." This white road that we're looking at here connects the city of Labna with another city called Kaba and another larger city, the capital of that area at that time, called Uxmal. Kilometers and kilometers away, and yet they had built these white paved roads that exist until today. We're looking at this. It's what did Americans know in 1829 about such things? Absolutely nothing. No American, no archaeologist in America or in the world interested in American archaeologists knew a thing about the ancient, beautiful Mayan civilization that existed in Central America. The great and beautiful cities of the Mayan civilization were not rediscovered until 1839. And then 3 years after that, its discoverer, a man named Stevens, a lawyer from New York City, who had paid an artist to go with him to Central America, and they made these explorations and they discovered these cities. And then they published a book 3 years after that. But their discoveries were 9 years after the Book of Mormon had been published and printed and published. 10 years after it had been printed and published. And what did people know about ancient America at that time when the Book of Mormon came forth? I'm going to go back to Victor von Hagen. In his biography of Stevens, he describes the attitudes of Americans toward the Indian people and the cultures of the time of the Book of Mormon was published. I'm quoting von Hagen. He says, "No one dreamed that throughout the tablelands of Mexico, in the tangled scrub jungles of Yucatan, there stood covered by jungle verdure ruins of temples, acropolises, and stone causeways of a civilization as great and extinct as Egypt's. The acceptance of an Indian civilization demanded to an American living in 1839 an entire reorientation. For to him, an Indian was one of those barbaric enemies that lived in teepees upon whom wars were constantly waged. Nor did one ever think of calling any other indigenous inhabitants of the continent civilized." That was the attitude among peoples at that particular point in history. Yet 12 years before the publication of Stevens' discovery of ancient magnificence, the Book of Mormon revealed exactly the high degree of civilization which would one day be discovered. An article in National Geographic compares the marvels of Maya to their counterparts in the Old World. Early travelers, dazzled by the culture of the Maya, compared them to the Greeks because of their science, to the Romans because of their well-drained paved roads, and to the Egyptians because of their pyramids. Now, more than 170 years has passed since that description was vindicated by Stephen's publication of his discovery, and every passing year brings new findings that demonstrate the accuracy of the culture, the history portrayed in the Book of Mormon, something that no one could have written with the knowledge available in 1829. The last writer in the narrative of the Nephite and Lamanite history wrote of one of the great destructions of the Nephite people. He told what was going to follow. He said this, I'm reading in Mormon chapter 4, verse 10. And behold, also the Lamanites are at war one with another. And the whole face of the land is one continual round of murder and bloodshed. And no one knoweth the end of the war. And I had to exercise my patience and my faith again, because that's just exactly opposite to the picture that was portrayed of the Mayan people by anthropologists and archaeologists. One of them says this, T.F. Gunn, in his History of the Maya, wrote, the Maya, judging by the scenes depicted upon the stele, were one of the least warlike nations who ever existed. The History of the Maya. Also, in Ancient Life of Mexico and Central America, we read, among the general characteristics to be noticed is the absence of the war implements and signs of combat in the sculptures, indicating a people living at peace and their neighbor, with their neighbor. It becomes obvious that there's a great disparity between the story we read in Mormon, in Moroni, and what the archaeologists are telling the world and writing in their books. So let's see what's happening in our day. I'm quoting a recent finding. In the last few years, new discoveries were being made in an article entitled Secrets of the Maya in 1993. Michael Lemonick wrote, the latest discoveries announced just this week underscores how quickly Mayan archaeology is changing. Among the first myths about this population to be debunked is that they were a peaceful race. To what new discoveries is he referring? Vanderbilt University anthropologist Arthur Demarest wrote in 1991, until recent years, scholars tended to idealize the Maya as people, as peaceful and industrious people. The only warfare was supposed to be limited, ritualized battles between rulers as part of a dynastic struggle, but rarely involved the common people. But from Guatemala, here in recent years, comes this report of new findings. The kingdom collapsed into warfare, far more destructive than we had ever imagined. The landscape and the settlement patterns became almost medieval as many smaller states fought for survival. On the stele that is shown here in this slide, you can see a scene of martial combat. One warrior is stabbing another in the chest. This is Demarest's findings as he worked in Guatemala. Uncontrolled warfare was probably one of the main causes for the Maya's eventual downfall. In the centuries after 250 A.D., just as the Book of Mormon describes, the skirmishes that were common among competing city-states escalated into full-fledged vicious wars that turned the proud cities to ghost towns. We easily see how this new, more accurate description of ancient America coincides hand in glove with the account found in the Book of Mormon, in both the social organization and in the time frame. In this present decade, the archaeologist is just now discovering what readers of the Book of Mormon have known for almost two centuries. I'm reminded of the words of Dr. Robert Jostrout. He was the founder of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies. He wrote this, for the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. Well, I kind of think that's kind of an interesting comment. In chapters 21 and 22 of Alma, we read that some of the Nephites remodeled their cities to make them more easily defendable. Let's examine an overview of the changes made. We're examining a chart that was made of an ancient city in Campeche called Bacan, made by an archaeologist, D.L. Webster. As you look at the... I better catch up here. As you look at the chart that Webster made, I'm going to read what it says in the Book of Mormon. A moat had been dug around the city, Alma 21, 170. The earth removed was made into an earthen bank behind the moat, verse 170. Set up on top this ridge was a walkway of timbers used by the defenders, chapter 22, verse 2. This walkway was protected by a strong fence of timbers, Alma 22:3. Defensive towers were placed along the walkway from place to place, verse 30. The only place one could enter was through an easily defensible entrance, 21:170. Of course, Demarest says this, I suspect that the palisade may have existed, but all traces of it have been obliterated. As we look at the entrance to this city, as Jim and I walked down through the what was remaining of the moat, and then we came up to the entrance, I took this picture. Let's read this description that we find here. It's written by Hernan Cortez. As he made his way from Mexico down to Guatemala, he passed right through this area where Bacan is today. And this is what he wrote in his book. There is but one accessible entrance, and all is surrounded by a deep moat behind which there is a palisade, breast high. And beyond this palisade, there is an enclosure of very thick planks, 2 fathoms high, with loopholes at all points from which to shoot arrows. Its watchtowers rise 7 or 8 feet higher than the said wall, which was provided with towers on top of which are many stones which they can fight from above. And so Cortez saw a city that was almost identical to the one that Webster was discovering and almost identical to what Alma described in the Book of Alma. Another Book of Mormon quote in Mosiah 5:35, we read, And behold, we at this time do pay tribute to the king of the Lamanites, to the amount of 1/2 of our corn and our barley and all our grains. This Book of Mormon statement has been long criticized by opponents of the Book of Mormon. Their basis of ridicule is a statement by the Smithsonian Institute. American Indians had no wheat, barley, oats, or millet before Columbus' arrival. And yet the Book of Mormon said they had barley. Another example for the need of patience. Years ago, there would have been no response to make to this claim. We have to exercise our faith and our patience. However, work on a new freeway in central Phoenix. I think Highway 51, which I enjoy very much, in 1980s, uncovered an ancient Hohokam village. New Arizona laws or federal laws require that when a work project reveals prehistoric sites, work must be delayed until salvage archaeologists can make a thorough study of the site. The archaeologists work this ancient Hohokam site have made a startling discovery, which turns this simple Book of Mormon statement into a strong testimony of its validity. In December issue of Science, 83, an article called Last Ditch Archaeology by Daniel Adams appeared. Adams wrote this, Perhaps the most startling evidence of Hohokam agricultural sophistication came last year when salvage archaeologists found preserved grains of what looks like domesticated barley, the first ever found in the New World. Wild barleys have a fibrous husk over the grain. Domestic barleys lack this. So does the Hohokam barley. As we look at this magnificent observatory in Chichen Itza. I want you to consider the simple words found in Alma 16:55. All the planets which move in their regular form. Professor Cyrus Gordon wrote this: nowhere is interdependence of the old and the new world clearer than in the domain of science. Astronomy, mathematics, and chronology bridge the two worlds so inextricably that it is impossible to understand the history of science in the one without the other. The Mayan year was more precise than any devised by the old world civilization. I would point out again that the narrative in the Book of Mormon is perfectly in harmony with the social organization, the cultural setting of the ancient time and place, and recent discoveries in archaeology have verified things that we read in the Book of Mormon almost every day. So, with apparent disparity occur, our duty is twofold. Have faith in what the Lord has revealed to you and be patient. So now let us turn to internal evidence of the Book of Mormon. There are three types of internal evidence that we're going to consider. It's what is actually written on the pages of the Book of Mormon. What is found written on the pages, the evidence within it. It's exactly what it claims to be, an ancient Semitic record written by a Semitic people. In this study, we shall consider three types of internal evidence. One example of Hebrew grammatical construction, and one Hebrew idiom of speech, and one Hebrew literary style. Let's consider an example of Hebrew grammar first. One prominent peculiarity of ancient Hebrew grammar found in the Bible is the frequent use of the conjunction and, both in the beginning of a sentence and in the listing of a series of words within that sentence. Theirs is like the simple speech of children, and it's not acceptable in English usage. Let's consider an example of Hebrew writing from the Bible and compare it with the grammatical style used by authors of the Book of Mormon. First, a Bible quotation. In the book of Genesis, chapter 4, verse 35, we read, and you'll notice I have some words underlined, words that would be omitted if written by an English educated person. And the Lord hath blessed my master greatly, and he has become great, and he hath given him flocks and herds and silver and gold and manservants and maidservants and camels and asses. Now, from the Book of Mormon, we're going to read one passage in the Book of Enos. And it came to pass that the people of Nephi did till the land and raise all manner of grain and of fruit and flocks of herds and flocks of all manner of cattle, of every kind, and goats, and wild goats, and also many horses. Each of those underlined ands would be omitted by an author who grew up speaking the English language. But Joseph Smith did not write the Book of Mormon. He translated what was already written. Now, let's consider another Hebrew henna, an idiom of speech. An idiom of speech. It refers to, if you translate it to English, it would be behold, or see, or lo. It is used in Hebrew to point out something, persons, things, places, actions. In English, it's not thought necessary, and it's rarely used. The minor prophets of the Old Testament, written by 31 by author, 10 authors on 31 pages, I found the henna appeared on these 31 pages that it appeared 51 times for an average usage of 1.6 times per page. In Joel chapter 3 is the typical example of this usage. Behold, in those days and in that time. Now, in the Book of Mormon, I had to study to try to find a comparable place where I could use 41 pages. I used pages 193 through 224 that were written by 9 authors instead of 10, but it's the closest I could come. And here the term lo or behold, this idiom was used 57 times, or an average of 1.9 times per page. This example comes from the book of Enos. Behold, I went to hunt beasts in the forest. And so we see that the Book of Mormon uses this Hebrew expression the same way that the authors of the Bible use this expression. Chiasms. I was glad to listen to your report from the your program of the Vacation Church School, that some of our children were studying about chiasms, how important that is. We're going to look at a literary style used by ancient Hebrews. Within the pages of the Bible, this style is frequently seen, even after being translated into English language, in both Old and New Testament. The literary style, called chiasmus, consists of a statement or a series of statements which contain two or more parts. For example, part A and part B. And then it's followed by the statement using the same words or thoughts, but in reverse order, B and A. Let's consider this example of the Old Testament here. So he shall open, and none shall shut. And he shall shut, and none shall open. And outlined like it is, and I did it here for the New Testament, but many that are first shall be last, and the last shall be first. So let us be reminded that this ancient literary style used by Hebrew writers has gone unrecognized for 2,000 years. When Jerusalem was overthrown by the Roman Empire and the Jewish people carried off captivity and spread throughout the nations wherever Roman Empire existed, this literary style was lost to the world. Nobody remembered it. No one knew anything about chiasmus, right until about 40 years after the Book of Mormon was published. In 1972, a man named Samuel Baxter and his sons published a book called The Companion Bible. This Bible is written in a way to show clearly, beautifully outline the ancient Jewish, poetic Jewish literary styles of parallelism, poetic patterns, and chiasmus. In the introduction of the Bible, the editors refer to the ancient literary styles as structures of the book. And then they make this statement. How interesting that statement is to me. Chiasmus is shown to be a symmetrical exhibition of the word itself, which may be discerned by the humblest reader of the sacred text and seen to be one of the most important evidences of the divine inspiration of its words. For these structures constitute a remarkable phenomenon peculiar to divine revelation, and are not found outside it in any other form of known literature. Well, I for one wish to thank the editors of the Companion Bible for their endorsement of the Book of Mormon as being divine revelation, for it is filled with chiasmus, some simple, some very complicated. Let's just take an example from the Book of Mormon. We find this chiasmus. We're looking at a simple one. They were made manifest unto the prophet by the voice of the Spirit. For by the Spirit are all things made known unto the prophets. It's a very simple chiasmus. Many of them found the Book of Mormon are much more complicated, difficult for people, even scholars, to identify them, because some of them cover several chapters in there, and they list dozens of outlines. I'm going to consider now a larger one, more complicated one. And it covers two chapters in the Book of Mormon in 3rd Nephi. In chapter 8 of 3rd Nephi, verses 28 to 43, we read about the communion service that Jesus held with the people upon his first arrival. In verses 47 to 57, we read about his prayer with the people. In verses 62 to 71, we read about the baptism and the 12 disciples. Then in 73 to 75, we read the ascension of Jesus back into heaven. This was a central point of the structure. Then chapter 9, in verses 4 to 16, we read about baptism and the 12 disciples. Then in verses 17 to 39, we read about the prayers of Jesus. And then in verses 40 to 45, he served the sacrament to them once again. A perfect example of a much more complicated chiasm. The authors of the Book of Mormon were skilled artisans in the use of chiasmus. No one would dare suggest that the unlettered youth, Joseph Smith, could have chanced upon such a literary style, developed it to this extent. This constitutes one of the indisputable pieces of evidence to the divinity, the veracity of the Book of Mormon, exactly what it claims to be. The following chiasm that we're going to look at is found in a Mayan book called the Popol Vuh. A literary scholar examined 37 ancient Mayan manuscripts. And in these 37 manuscripts, he found that 16 of them contained this ancient Hebrew literary style that descendants of the Book of Mormon peoples still employed this ancient literary style at the time of the conquest by the Spanish. Additional evidence that their ancestors came from ancient Israel, just as their traditions had declared. Now, this one that I'm going to read from the Popol Vuh is so long it takes two slides, so we'll start here. O heart of heaven, and once it had been created, the earth, the mountains and valleys, the paths of the water were divided, and they proceeded to twist among the hills. This was a central line. And so the rivers then became more divided, and the great mountains were appearing. And thus was the creation of the earth when it was created by him who is the heart of heaven. We're looking at a destroyed city of Caba in Yucatan. Well, I think we have shown that archaeological discoveries demonstrate that the Book of Mormon has long portrayed a more accurate description of social organization and ancient inhabitants of Mesoamerica than previous understandings of the scientists and archaeological positions had shown. The Book of Mormon stands firm on solid ground in descriptions of ancient Mesoamerica, while men of science must regularly adjust their position to conform to new discoveries. Native American traditions demonstrate that Book of Mormon presented an accurate picture of ancient American culture, religion, and thought. Internal evidences from the pages of the Book of Mormon itself firmly substantiate that it was an ancient record written by peoples well-versed in Hebraic styles of writing. It was passed down to their descendants until the time of the conquest by the Spanish. Conforming as it does to scientific discoveries and Native American traditions, there can be nothing unreasonable about the narrative. Last slide is of Palenque in Chiapas, a beautiful Mayan temple, the burial place of their king. These constitute the recognized criteria for determining a book is really of ancient origin. The Book of Mormon passes on all counts. The internal evidence is like icing on the cake. What makes it even more convincing is that the fact that the evidences we have referred to was totally unknown at the time the Book of Mormon was published. It is beyond all realm of possibility that an unlettered young man could have written a book containing so many historic truths, Hebraic manners of speech, which were completely unknown to scientists and scholars of his day. Definitely points to the fact the book was written by authors living in ancient Mesoamerica, familiar with the teachings and the history of the Jews. So I thank you for your attention. I'm going to leave this slide on while somebody turns on the lights. And I'm sure this program was too long, but I could have made it twice as long, so I exhibited much patience and care for your feelings.